This lecture, entitled How to Create Meaningful and Lasting Relationships, is dedicated to the memory of Avrom Ben Shlomo, Dr. Arnold Zuroff, of blessed memory.
One of the most difficult and profound works in our literature is the book of Job, Sefer Iyov. Job, the subject of the book, was a righteous man who was blessed with a large and wonderful family, as well as with inordinate material wealth. After being struck with repeated tragedies, his children, much of his wealth, were taken from him, became afflicted with an intolerably painful disease. He was visited by his three friends. According to the Talmud, they each traveled an enormous distance to be at his side. They shared the burden of his pain and attempted to help him to come to grips with the events that had totally shattered his view of himself and the world. It was through their involvement and the involvement of yet another friend that Job eventually not only made peace with his condition, but lived to see much joy in his life. Regarding this story, the Talmud in Bava Basra in 16b makes the comment, O chavrusa kechavrei de'iov, O misusa, either friends like the friends of Job, or death. In other words, basically, life is not worth living if you don't have such friends. In yet another context, the Talmud makes a similar comment. One of the great legendary figures of Jewish history was Choni Hamagel. Choni, the circle maker. The events of the life of this saint are recorded in the Talmud, as well as in the works of the ancient Jewish historian Josephus Flavius. After having outlived his contemporaries, Choni found himself alone and unappreciated amongst a new generation that was unable to understand his intellectual and spiritual greatness. Choni prayed to God to take his soul, and he said again those words, O chavrusa, O misusa, either death or friends. According to the Talmud, then, a life lived alone without having friends or being appreciated is a life that's almost unbearable. We all need friends. Having a friend to be there at your side at a time of grief or distress, or having a friend as a companion through life to reinforce one's sense of worth and dignity, are only but two of the many benefits that come with cultivating friendships. The importance of having a friend, being a friend, and how to cultivate lasting friendships is the topic of tonight's lecture. We've divided this lecture into seven sections, as you noticed in the first page of your handout. The first letter of the title of each section spelling out the mnemonic acronym, FRIENDS. The F of friends, as you see on page 2, stands for friendship. We're going to discuss the importance of having a friend and the importance of being a friend. There are at least 5 advantages of having a friend. In order to remember them, and again I've spelled out a mnemonic, the first letter of these 5 advantages spells out the word light. So that you should remember them. And the L of light stands for, if you notice, lift you up when you are down. And here I quote a verse from Ecclesiastes, from Kohelis. Two are better than one, this is from the 4th chapter, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, the one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him that is alone when he falleth, for he hath not another to help him up. The Talmud put it this way, Ein chovush mater atzmoi beis asurim. A prisoner cannot release himself from captivity without the help of a friend. Not only is it because we inherently lack the strength to extricate ourselves from a difficult situation. But in the midst of that difficulty, we more often than not lack the ability to see things clearly and objectively. We get nervous. This is essentially the importance of the mitzvah of Nichum Avelim, of comforting the mourner, giving a mourner a needed sense of perspective and the emotional strength to cope with an often devastating loss. The Talmud, this is in Tainus, in 22a, relates the following story. Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, was speaking to a certain rabbi, Rabbi Baroka. And he pointed out two people in the marketplace, and he said, "See these two people? These two have a special share in the world to come." Rabbi Baroka then approached and asked them, "Gentlemen, what's your occupation? What do you do?" They replied, "We're comedians. We see people depressed, we try to cheer them up. Furthermore, when we see two people quarreling, we strive hard to make peace between them." Now, these two comedians were extraordinary individuals. That's why they have a special place in the world to come. But normally, though, if you have good friends, friends can often do the same. And if you don't have personal friends, you can't count on that others will become involved to help you. I don't know if you remember, this is some years ago, the story of Kitty Genovese, that she was murdered in Queens. No one lifted a finger to help her. In other words, at the very least, creating friends is a form of insurance. We take elaborate measures to check our competing insurance plans, to make sure we have all that we or our loved ones need in a time of emergency, whether it be fire, health, life insurance. Cultivating friends is a form of emergency insurance. The cost of that insurance is, of course, your willingness to do the same when your friend or friends are in need. As you well know, friendship is not a one-way street. You have to be a friend to have a friend. I'd like to read an extraordinary story that my daughter read in school. It's from the period of the Vietnam War. It's a very touching story that the writer claims actually did occur. And I'm reading this story. Whatever their planned target, the mortar rounds landed in an orphanage run by a missionary group in the small village. The missionaries and one or two children were killed outright, and several more children were wounded, including one young girl about 8 years old. People from the village requested medical help from a neighboring town that had radio contact with the American forces. Finally, an American Navy doctor and nurse arrived in a jeep with only their medical kits. They established that the girl was the most critically injured. Without quick action, she would die of shock and loss of blood. A transfusion was imperative, and a donor with a matching blood type was required. A quick test showed that neither American had the correct type, but several of the uninjured orphans did. The doctor spoke some pidgin Vietnamese, and the nurse a smattering of high school French. Using that combination, together with much impromptu sign language, they tried to explain to their young, frightened audience that unless they could replace some of the girl's lost blood, she would certainly die. Then they asked if anyone be willing to give blood to help. The request was met with wide-eyed silence. After several long moments, a small hand slowly and waveringly went up, dropped back down, and then went up again. "Oh, thank you," the nurse said in French. "What is your name?" "Heng," came the reply. Heng was quickly laid on a pallet, his arm swabbed with alcohol, and a needle inserted in his vein. Through this ordeal, Heng lay stiff and silent. After a moment, he let out a shuddering sob, quickly covering his face with his free hand.
Is it hurting, Heng? The doctor asked. Heng shook his head, but after a few moments, another sob escaped, and once more he tried to cover up his crying. Again the doctor asked him if the needle hurt, and again Heng shook his head. But now his occasional sobs gave way to a steady, silent crying. His eyes screwed tightly shut, his fist in his mouth to stifle the sobs. The medical team was concerned. Something was obviously very wrong. At this point, a Vietnamese nurse arrived to help. Seeing the little one's distress, she spoke to him rapidly in Vietnamese, listened to his reply, and answered him in a soothing voice. After a moment, the patient stopped crying and looked questioningly at the Vietnamese nurse. When she nodded, a look of great relief spread over his face. Glancing up, the nurse said quietly to the Americans, quote, "He thought he was dying. He misunderstood you. He thought you would ask him to give all his blood so the little girl could live." "But why would he be willing to do that?" asked the Navy nurse. The Vietnamese nurse repeated the question to the little boy, who answered simply, quote, "She's my friend," end quote. Greater love has no man than this, that he laid down his life for a friend. That's the end of the article. The story, of course, speaks for itself. Now, according to Jewish law, one is not required, nor is one even allowed, under most circumstances, to give up his own life to save another one's life. But I'm sure all of you would like to have a friend like this. That's the L of light, to lift you up. When you're in need, there's a friend for you. And that takes us now to the I of light, which is inspire you. We're speaking up now about physical help. A person's in distress, he needs someone to help him, to lift him up. There's another function of having a friend. That's for inspiration. And there's an aphorism in Pirkei Avos, in Ethics of the Father, in the fourth chapter. It says, "Be thou a tail unto lions, and not a head unto foxes." It's better to be part of people that inspire you, that will lift you up, even though your position amongst them may be very minor. But it's better that than being the head of a group, that you're the head. You have to give the inspiration to them, but you have no source of inspiration for yourself. I'd like to quote to you, this is taken from the Talmud, there's a Gemara in Ksubas 111b. There's a verse in the Torah, in Deuteronomy, in the fourth chapter, in Parshas Veschanan. But you held fast, you cleaved to the Lord your God, are alive, every one of you this day. This is what Moses was telling the people. The Talmud comments on the idea of cleaving, holding fast, holding on to God. And he says, for most of us, how do we hold on to God? The Talmud brings the idea that God is a devouring fire. It means it's a tremendous source of energy. How do you hold on to him? It seems for a scholar, it's through the study of Torah. But someone who's not a scholar, but at least he holds on to those who are holding on. And it says, a man who marries his daughter to a scholar, so he has that relationship with a scholar, or carries on a trade on behalf of scholars, or benefits scholars from his estate, is regarded by Scripture as if he had held fast to the divine presence. And similarly, the Talmud comments, there's a requirement, a commandment, to love the Lord your God, to hearken to his voice, and to cleave unto him. Again, the idea of holding fast. And again, is it possible for a human being to cleave unto the divine presence? And the Talmud answers, what's meant by this is any man who marries, again, the same thing, marries his daughter to a scholar, carries on a trade for scholars, benefits scholars from his estate, regarded by scriptures if he had cleaved to the divine presence. Because when you're in the presence of holy people, you feel holy. And of course, when you're in the presence of people that are less than holy, you yourself are brought down. And this is, we quote it here, if you notice in your notes, inspire you. We quote it here, this is also an aphorism that's taken from the second chapter of Ethics of the Fathers, of Obos. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked his disciples, he had five disciples, he says, go out and discern, think about, which is the proper way that a man should cling? If there's any one thing that a person should concentrate on, what is that one thing? Each one of the disciples came up with a different idea. But Rabbi Yeshua's idea was having a good friend. Make the effort of having a good friend. And basically we're saying, at least part of it is to have someone to lift you up. And again, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked his disciples, and what is that, if there would be one thing that you would avoid, what would it be? And again, Rabbi Yeshua said, that would be distance yourself from a wicked friend, a bad friend. So we spoke about the L, again, is to lift you up, because you need someone to help you physically. And the I is we need someone to inspire you. Again, if you live alone, there's no one, you don't have interaction with people that are inspiring, you just won't be inspired. The one who's, I guess it seems from the context, one who devotes himself to study, to meditation, he has it from the Torah itself. But if you don't, at least you have it from those that do. So that's the inspire. G is guide you. And we quote here, if you notice, this is Da'oga Belev Ish Yashchena. This is a person, his worry in his heart. This is a verse in Proverbs. Says the question is Yashchena, boweth it down. The simple meaning is that if you have worries, put them aside. But there's an additional meaning which the Talmud discusses, because of the use of that term, those letters can be read also Yasichena. Speak it over with a friend. If you have problems, part of the idea of a friend is a sounding board. You never know what kind of advice your friend can give you. One of the functions of a friend is guidance. So, of course, there's the idea you have someone to speak to in times of need that's to lift you up. You give emotional strength. But there's also the advice that a person can give you. You know, there's a story that which is recorded actually in the Bible, in the Book of Kings, but the Talmud itself comments on this. You're all familiar with King Solomon. King Solomon, who was the king of the entire country, when he passed away, the kingdom fell to his son, Rehoboam. Now there was a problem, as there's problems always, and there's problems in this country, about what to do with the taxes. The northern part of the country felt that they were overburdened by the taxes and asked the new king to cut the taxes, to ease the burden. There was a difference between Rehoboam's advisors as how to proceed next. The advisors that he inherited from his father, King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, were older people, more experienced, and they felt if the people really feel that the tax burden is too onerous, then it should be reduced. His personal, Rehoboam, the new king's personal friends, however, they were young people, didn't have the experience. They said, "says we have to show them. Says they're complaining, we're going to add to the tax burden. We're going to show them who's in charge." Well, he listened to his younger friends, and the northern kingdom rebelled and never came back. That northern kingdom called itself Yisrael, similarly Yisrael, just as the present government today. They were eventually conquered, to a great extent lost to history. These are the 10 lost tribes. But it all came originally from bad advice. Again, one of the important things of making sure you have a friend, you have someone to rely on, someone to give you good advice, which comes next to the H, as we have L is lift you up, I is inspire you, G is guide you, H is help you. And again, if you look at your notes, we quote again from Ecclesiastes. It's about having a friend. This is about having friends, sir. If one prevail against him, two shall withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. The H is to help you, to protect you. You know, there's strength in numbers. You're not alone. You know, the advice we give to our children is, you know, walk in pairs. You know, if there's a questionable area. So here the help is really preventive. The L of lift you up is you have a problem, they lift you up. But the H is if you're part of a community and you're not alone, a lot of good comes through that. And finally, in this section, T is teach you. We spoke about the G to guide you. This is advice, day-to-day advice. There's the I inspire you. But there's actually to have a friend really to help you, that really to teach you real wisdom. And here we quote, this is the English is on page 3, about it's not good to be alone. You come up with certain ideas that if they're not, they don't go through a peer review, so to speak. You don't bounce it off others. There can be real problems with it. And the Talmud further on, you know, comes to the conclusion. It says, you know, I've learned many things from my teachers, but I learned more things from my friends. So again, let me just repeat this. We're going to the next section here, but it's important really to have good friends. They lift you up, they inspire you, they guide you, they help you, and they teach you. How do you acquire a friend? This is the next part. And that's the acquiring a friend. Now, it's interesting. Again, there's an aphorism here. We quote here. It's on page 3. And we quote here. It's from the first chapter of Pirkei Avos of Ethics of the Fathers. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Paracha used to say, appoint for yourself a teacher and acquire for yourself a friend. The word acquire is similar to the word we use when you want to acquire goods, like buy. It doesn't necessarily in a sense buy, but it's an acquisition. An acquisition generally has connotes the idea that it's an investment. When you want to buy something, you put something in, you get something in return. And we quote here in the notes, we quote here from the commentary of Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah, who has a running commentary on Ethics of the Fathers, Pirkei Avos, was one of the great rabbinic leaders of the 13th century. He was the, the city of Toledo, Ohio? It's named after a city in Spain. It's Toledo. He was the chief rabbi of Toledo. And he now explains, what is the idea of acquiring a friend? What is that? What's the notion? And here it says, and I'm quoting from him, and the reason that the Mishnah expresses itself in terms of acquisition is because the Mishnah is telling us that if a friend cannot find a friend without paying for one, he should acquire one through his wealth and spend his money to get hold of a good friend. In other words, basically we know, in order to do business,
You have to cultivate a client. You take them out. It's no worse than having a friend. And it continues on, or alternately, it means that one should acquire, actually keep a friend through appeasing him verbally. In other words, he speaks on two levels. One is actually getting a friend, and one is keeping a friend. And he says, how do you keep a friend? And it's evidently, from we see all the words that he uses towards this, it's not easy. It's through appeasing him verbally and in a soft tone, and he shouldn't become impatient with his affairs, but rather he should bear the brunt of his statements, even though they may be directed against him. You know, sometimes friends are careless, and sometimes they're hurtful. But if you want to keep that friend, you have to have the patience and the forbearance. And he should not retort in kind. For without this forbearance, the love amongst friends will not remain. The reason for this is the personalities of people are different. And this is what King Solomon meant when he said in Proverbs in the 17th chapter, he who hides the wrongdoings of others, like he forgets about them, is actually seeking love. If you keep on harping, and this is in marriage, but this is in friendships, if you always keep on harping about the past, it's just not going to work. You have to be able to forget. So part of the acquisition really means it takes work to have a friend. It takes work. And then there's an investment in acquiring a friend. And there's really an investment of like psychological, energy to maintain the friend. But, you know, in terms of acquiring, this notion is really not unique to friendship. You know, when it comes to mitzvahs, you know, to doing something good, mitzvahs worth doing is often a mitzvah that you have to pay for. I'm reminded of a very cute story. It must be a Yiddish folk story. So just one of those great stories. You know, Jews are always, you know, we've lived, you know, through our history a difficult life as well. And very often, stereotypically, we're always out to save money. Well, having that in mind, I want to tell you the following story. But part of Jewish tradition, of course, is hosting guests and being gracious. And we don't have it to the same extent that it was in Eastern Europe. But in Eastern Europe, there was much poverty, and there was a beggar class. And very often, there would be itinerant beggars. They would go from village or city to city. They didn't really have homes. Unfortunately, they didn't have much. And it was the custom for Jews who were blessed with more to take them in, at least temporarily. Communities would often have a special home for these people. It was set aside. The name that was used was Hegdish. A Hegdish. Hegdish is really a guest house for these itinerant beggars. So as the story goes, this folk story, that an itinerant beggar came to be a guest to this person who happened to be very stingy. He had to feed him, but he really didn't want to part with his money. So he went to the fish store, and he asked for fish for his guest. And of course, the price, every piece of fish that was offered to him was too expensive. In fact, don't you have anything cheaper? Well, we have this fish that has been sitting around for a week already. I'm about to throw it out. Give me a quarter, and I'll give it to you. So fine. He gave him the quarter. He took the fish. He prepared it. Gave it to the guest. It tasted a little different, but the guest thanked him for it, went back to his room in the Hegdish, you know, in this guest house, and started feeling ill. Evidently, it was quite well infected with salmonella. He developed a stomach illness. Having pity on this poor guest, of course, the host came to visit him in the guest house. Very nice and gracious. Of course, the pain and the illness got worse and worse, and finally the guest died. And of course, the host was there at his funeral as well. And after the body was buried, he felt quite good. The hostess says, look at here. I got three mitzvahs. Hachnosas Orchem, I brought in a guest. Says, Biker Cholem, says, I visited the sick. Levoyas Hameis, says, I escorted the dead, and all for just a quarter. But we should do better investments, in other words. And in terms of the other part of this Rabbeinu Yonah, about keeping a friend, you know, as we said, it's very important to have a friend. A good friend's too precious to lose. You may not get another one like that. And then learning to tolerate the person's shortcomings is maybe a good trade-off for all of the benefits you have of having a friend. You know, it's funny. I remember when I, years ago, it was before I met my wife, and I was beginning the dating process, and I had a friend in yeshiva. Today he's a Rosh Yeshiva in Israel. And he told me about the man who looked and looked for the perfect woman. And finally he found her. But she was looking for the perfect man. It's important to realize our friends aren't necessarily going to be perfect. But if they have wonderful qualities, it's important to have the patience, the forbearance, to keep, to tolerate the shortcomings in order to retain the good. Sometimes, you know, in life, we don't have patience. But I'd like to share with you another beautiful, this is a beautiful folk story. This story was told over by Rav Nachman of Breslov. Nachman of Breslov was one of the great Hasidic grand rabbis, rebbes in Europe. He died in the year 1810. He had a whole following in his lifetime and after his lifetime. But he was a master storyteller amongst his gifts. And the following is one of his stories. We spoke previously about these itinerant beggars. Well, the story was about two beggars who went from town to town. One was a Jew and one was a non-Jew. And they went from town to town, and it was close to Passover. And the Jewish beggar told the non-Jewish beggar, you know, the food on Passover is out of this world. But I'm afraid if they realize you're not Jewish, you're not going to be able to attend the Seder and all, you know, the all that comes with it. You don't know the language. You don't know Yiddish. Pretend you're a deaf mute. They'll have pity on you. They'll invite you to the Seder. It's going to be a little while. You'll come. They'll drink a little wine. They'll talk. But eventually the meal will begin. So as the custom was after the services in the evening, on the holidays or on Shabbos, the beggars would stand at the back of the shul. And the shamish, the sexton, the supervisor of the shul, would allocate, you know, different people, beggars, those who were in need, to different homes. So the Jewish beggar got to one home, and his friend, the non-Jewish beggar, went to a different home. He hadn't eaten all day. He was very hungry, this non-Jewish beggar. And he pretended he's a deaf mute, so it was okay. And first they had the wine, so that was okay. Then they had some parsley or potato, whatever the custom was. And then they kept on talking. They kept on talking and talking through the Seder. And finally, they got ready, they washed their hands, and they ate this very hard, thin bread. It was the matzah. You never tasted anything like this. And into his mind, he was cursing his friend. What did he do to me? And this is a, must some practical joke.
You told me about all this great food and all the everything. This is all I haven't eaten, and I'm halfway through the night, and this is all they're giving me. And finally, he came to the moror. He came to the bitter herbs, which in that country was chrein, was horseradish. And he hadn't eaten, and he took a big glob of this horseradish. He had never tasted it. His mouth was on fire. He was cursing his friends, his practical joke. He just bolted out of that house, ran to the edge of the town, to the Hegdish, to the guest house, and he was waiting furiously for his friend to come back. He's waiting and waiting, 3 hours. Finally, his friend comes back. His friend comes back. Friend's singing. He looks at him. He says, "What took you so long? Look what you did to me." He says, "What happened?" He told him the story. He says, "Are you crazy? If you had just waited a moment longer," he says, "you would have had eggs, gefilte fish, chicken soup, chicken compote. You'd have a whole meal. You just didn't have the patience to wait out when it was bitter." And that's Rav Nachman's story. Very often in life, it doesn't always start off on a high. But if you hang in there, the good things will come. Now, I want to go now. The F was friends. We speak about the importance of having friends and acquiring a friend. Rabbeinu Yonah spoke about two aspects of acquiring a friend. One is cultivating, could be investment, and one of tolerance. There are other aspects, though, equally important of friendship. And that comes to the R, which is respect. And if you notice here, we quote, this is also from Ethics of the Father in Pirkei Avos. This is from the fourth chapter. "Who is he that is honored? He who honors his fellow man." If you want to be honored, you need to honor others. We've spoken about acquisition, tolerance, but it's important, if you want to have a friend and keep a friend, you have to respect and honor that friend. One of the most popular books of all time was Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. If one were to summarize the entire book in one sentence, it would be the aphorism which we just quoted. How do you become honored and appreciated? By honoring and appreciating others. Everyone needs to be respected. It's important to us to have the sensitivity not to look for our respect, but if we focus on the other person, and what they need, and the respect that they need and deserve, automatically, the person will be appreciative and will return that respect. And it's important, just as Dale Carnegie himself makes the point, it's not a matter of flattery. It's sincere appreciation. To recognize the greatness in every person, and let the person know it. You know, very often we do so much for other people and then we feel, you know, I don't get any appreciation. It's important to tell them. You really appreciate it. And, you know, by imparting a sense of dignity to your friend, you're doing that person a service that really no money could buy. But there's a corollary to this, of course. One we see is giving the respect. But there's a tendency when we have friends and we take that friend for granted, we fail very often to respect the privacy of our friend. The friend needs privacy as well. They need their space. And here I quote on the bottom here, page 3. This is from Proverbs. "Make thy foot rare in thy neighbor's house, lest he be wary of thee, and so hate thee." You know, it's, don't overdo it. In other words, you need the friend, but you have to be a friend. And you have to respect their privacy. I would just And it's this sense of the sensitivity that's also the extremely important of the maintenance of friendships. But I'm just reminded again with a beautiful story I heard from an in-law of mine. It's a great story. It's an absurd Yiddish story, but it's so beautiful. And I'll translate the Yiddish to you. It's one of those great stories. The whole basis is absurd, but it's just so beautiful. The story goes that the Pope Pius had a personal secretary who was Jewish, and his name was Mendel. And very often Mendel would speak to the Pope in Yiddish. And when he would come in and bring him in the morning his paper, his coffee, he would come in and tell him, "No, was helzach nayes, Pius?" Let me translate the Yiddish. Vos means, it's German, Yiddish means what? Helt, to hear, like it's similar to, if English is a Germanic language. Was helzach, like what's heard, nayes is news, like what's news? So, but it rhymes, and Pius, of course, his name. Was helzach nayes, Pius. One morning when he comes in, as the norm, he would bring in his coffee and his paper and his breakfast, and he would say, "Nu, was helzach nayes, Pius?" The Pope says, "Tomorrow is Easter Sunday. We're having a conclave of the cardinals. Last time you came in and brought me my coffee in front of all of them and said, 'Was helzach nayes, Pius?' I was very embarrassed." "Please, Mendel, this time at least, don't take the liberties. It's fine. I'll know exactly what to do." After Easter is the holiday of Christendom. And he brings in front of all the cardinals, he brings in his coffee and his breakfast, and he's giving to the other cardinals. He goes, looks to Pope Pius, and he says, "Good yontif, pontiff." So, you have a friend, treat them with sensitivity and respect. Now this comes to the next part, which is interest. We quote here, again, if you notice from the quotations, we quote here from Ovos in the second chapter. Rabbi Eliezer said, "Let the honor of thy friend be as dear to you, thee, as thine own." We know that there's a mitzvah, v'ahavtel l'reacha kamocha, you should love your friend as yourself. Here we put it a little differently. The honor that you want, the respect that you want for yourself, well, give that to your friend. Rabbi Yosef, further on, said, "Let the property of thy fellow be as precious unto thee as thine own." In other words, you have to treat his property with the same respect as you would treat your own. The basic is, again, really to take a genuine interest in the needs of your friend. He needs respect. He needs to be cared for. There's a beautiful quote that friends are those rare people who ask you how you are and wait for an answer. That's the idea of interest. Very often, because they're friends, we have friends, we tend to take them and their friendship for granted and forget they have needs and sensitivities and not just there to serve us. So don't, as we said, it's important not to abuse the friendship, don't start to take liberties, but caring for your friends is a responsibility, often needs much forethought. Very often we're just trained, we got to help. Sometimes, as we said, they need their privacy. Sometimes they need... You have to feel their needs. You know, I'm reminded of a very cute story of two Russians that come out of an inn. They're both drunk. And one says to the other, Ivan, says, do you love me? He says, of course I love you. He says, do you really love me? Of course. He says, tell me what hurts me. If you really love me, you know what I feel. You know what I hurt. So I will leave you this section here with another little story. This is not a Jewish story, but it's a precious little story about a little boy who comes home all battered. His scratches and his blood. And the mother, alarmed, looks at him and he asks, what happened to you? Well, you know, I'm a Boy Scout. Yeah. And we're supposed to help old ladies cross the street. Yeah. She didn't want to go. Yeah. The E is empathy. You know, part of the thing is, you know, when you have a problem, part of a friend, of course, is to give advice, is to guide. But sometimes when you have a problem, and a lot of problems really don't have good solutions. You know, we have problems that just don't have solutions. But at least speaking it out, and you have someone who's a sympathetic listener, lightens the burden. So part of the responsibility, again, of having a friend is being a friend, is that sense of empathy. There, I quote here, this is on page 4, you notice E of empathy, again from Ovos. And as, if you notice, I've quoted an awful lot from Ethics of the Fathers. It's really a treasury of wisdom. And if you haven't dedicated some time to study, it's widely available in the bookstores, and it's printed in many of the prayer books and the Siddurim. It's really a font of knowledge. This is taken from a statement that says that in order to become a true Torah scholar, there are 48 ingredients, 48 ways of wisdom. There's 48 ingredients to becoming a true Torah scholar. One of them is, as a quote, is the true Torah scholar shares in the bearing of a burden with his colleague. Nosa ba'ol m'chavera. Says that he shares the burden. This is the empathy. Some of us Jewish do it, you know, very perfunctorily. You know, I'm reminded on the internet, someone put up a site where one could contact psychotherapeutic help, so just through a website. Basically, all the website does is they tell you, you know, please talk, and then you hear a voice, after a while, and yes, and it keeps on going. Here we're thinking about real empathy. And I'm reminded of a story that I heard from, an old Jewish story I heard from my father, of a blessed memory. But it's just very cute, which illustrates this idea. There was a very poor man in Germany who had 3 daughters to marry off. In other words, he needed to provide for a dowry to set up, you know, a house for his daughters. And of course, if he didn't have the money, the prospective grooms would not come his way. He didn't have any source where he's going to get the money, but he figured, you know, the famous Jewish banker Rothschild, maybe he would have compassion on him if he only told Rothschild his story. It was very difficult to get to the famous Jewish banker Rothschild. And he went, so the man got the courage up, mustered the courage, went to his bank, and says, I would like to speak to Herr Rothschild. He says, I want to speak to Mr. Rothschild. So the person who took in the request said, you know what? You see these desks here? Speak to the man on the first desk. He may help you. He sat down, told his tale of woe about his financial position, his three daughters, and the man nodded sympathetically, and he says, you know what? Speak to the man in the next desk, in the next desk. And again, he went to the next desk, and again, he tells over his whole story, and he nods, uh-huh. That's terrible. Yes. Speak to that man here on the next desk. And again, he goes to the third desk, again, tells the same story. And then the man tells him after he tolls over and pours his heart out, go right through that door. Excited, he goes right through the door and finds himself out in the street. And to this, the man commented in Yiddish, and I'll explain it. Geben wie geben, they really don't give. But a system, hoben say. They really have a system here. So that's the E of empathy. The N, what we call is non-threatening. And here is the, we quote here from a Gemara in the Talmud in Brachos in 17a. And we could read this together. A favorite saying of Abaye was, a man should always be subtle in the fear of heaven. Means basically he has to realize that if he wants to be truly a spiritual person, there are many pitfalls. And he has to think a step ahead if he wants to maintain his integrity. And he said, and next to the things, a soft answer turneth away wrath. You know, sometimes you have people and they're very agitated. And if you're going to be equally agitated, you're only going to make things worse. A soft answer, it tones down it turns the emotion. It makes it, there's a sympathy and softness. It brings things to a more rational level. One should always be on the best terms with his brethren and his relatives, with all men, even with a heathen in the street, in order that he may be beloved above and well-liked below and be acceptable to his fellow creatures. This basically should always have that mannerism of always being a demeanor of being basically non-threatening, being always cordial. Now, friends necessarily aren't sycophants. They're not always yes men. They're there, as we said, to guide you, to inspire you, to teach you. But raising your voice when the other raises their voice and creating that kind of opposition is really not helpful for anyone. And really one has to, the friendship really and how the advice is given has to be given in a really, to be effective. Even when rebuke is given, it should be done in an effective, in a calm manner. And it should be done with dignity and understanding. And with that, I'd like to share with you another story. A beautiful story. I don't know how much you'll remember of this whole lecture, but I hope you remember at least the stories, not the jokes. A beautiful story, again, from Rav Nachman of Breslov. Remember, he was the one who authored the story about the Maurer, you know, the horseradish and the beggar on Pesach. The name of the title of this story he calls The Turkey Prince. And the story goes as follows. But there's a tremendous story, but it's just like that story with the horseradish. There's a tremendous moral to the story. As the story goes, there was a prince, the son of a king, who became, at least temporarily, became insane and claimed that he was a turkey. He took off all of his clothing. He refused to eat human food. He was under the table making sounds like a turkey. Of course, the father couldn't reason with him. They brought in the biggest experts that were available at the time, and they couldn't do anything for him. The father was heartbroken. A wise man happened to be visiting that kingdom. He had an audience with the king and says, perhaps I can help you. He says, the king says, how could you help me when the greatest experts couldn't do anything? He said, I have an approach that perhaps they didn't think of. If I'm not successful, you don't owe me anything. So you have nothing to lose. The king agreed. And with that, the wise man came to the prince, took off all his clothes, went under the table and started also making turkey sounds and only eating food which was given, the grains or whatever that's only given to turkeys. Well, initially the prince was very suspicious. You know, there's a new turkey on the block. But after a while, he became... The idea of having a friend, another friend who was a human turkey, settled well with him. And they soon became fast friends. And this went on for some weeks. They were gobbling together, and as they were making sounds, they ate turkey food. Two turkeys made for each other. One day, the wise man told the prince, you know what? I'm just being under this table is hard on my knees. You know, let's sit down. Sit down. Turkeys don't sit down. We're going to show the world. We'll be turkeys and we're going to sit down. And with that, he convinced the prince and they both sat down at the table. Again, they were not clothed. They ate the grains the turkeys ate and they made the sounds the turkeys make, but at least they were sitting at the table. A few weeks later, the wise man tells the prince, you know, it's getting cold. I feel a draft. Let's put on some clothes. These turkeys don't put on clothes. We're going to show the world. We're going to be turkeys and we're going to wear clothes. He convinced the prince, and now at least they were both clothed, sitting at a table, still making turkey sounds, and eating grains, whatever turkeys eat, but at least there was a step in the right direction. A few more weeks went by, and the wise man told the prince, you know, this food's boring. I want some steak and potatoes. Steak and potatoes? Turkeys don't eat steak and potatoes. We're going to be turkeys. We'll show the world. And we're going to eat steak and potatoes. Well, he finally convinced the prince. And finally, again, he was at least sitting at a table, having clothes, eating human food. And little by little, the wise man convinced the prince to live a human life. Eventually, the prince was cured. Evidently, this is Reb Nachman's story. But the moral of the story is, you know, very often, just by telling the person the truth, or by using a direct method, you won't be successful. Something has to go through increments. You just can't tell it all. But little changes with tremendous patience, not lifting up your voice, but just slowly can have tremendous results. And that's the story of the Turkey Prince. I want to get now to the end. D is what I call is death. And it revolves around a very interesting story, which is recorded in the Talmud. The Talmud records that when Alexander the Great, in his great in his conquest of the Persian Empire, came to the Middle East and went through Palestine, eventually came to Egypt, he stopped and visited with the sages of Israel. And they had a long conversation. One of the topics of that conversation is recorded here. It's in the Talmud. It's in the Tractate Talmud. It's 32a. He said to them, referring to Alexander, what shall a man do to live? That's to enjoy life. What do you do to enjoy life? They replied, let him mortify himself. Basically, Yamasatma killed himself. We're going to explain this. And what should a man do to kill himself? They replied, let him keep himself alive. Of course, they're speaking in riddles here, in code language. And the commentaries explain the following. What should a person do to enjoy life? To be humble. knows the metaphor. To kill oneself means to keep oneself low, to respect other people. Don't impose yourself on others. People are comfortable with humble people. People are comfortable with people who respect them. They don't seek their own, but really are out really to find the good in others. And you know what? You may not build yourself up, but people really enjoy your company, and it's a very comfortable life. That's how you live. So what do you do to die? And there's an untimely death. And again, this is in poetic language. To try to make yourself alive. Try to impose yourself on others. Try to show them how great you are. People don't like it. People, in fact, is that there's an automatic reaction, and you get so, the person who tries, to build himself up, gets such resistance that the frustration, the aggravation, brings the heartache and an untimely death. So, what should a person do? Keep a low profile. That's the D, the death. Is humility. But there are people, of course, that just think about themselves. There's no room for anybody else. I mean, that's the other part of the equation, which, again, reminds me of a beautiful, again, Jewish folk story. And that's the story of Herschel Ostropolier. This Herschel Ostropolier was a... I don't know if all the stories about him are true, but he was a real individual. I don't know if you're familiar, the founder of the Hasidic movement was known as Rav Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. He had a grandson. His name is his daughter. He had a daughter and a son. His daughter's name was Odel, and he and Odel had three children. One of their children was named Boruch, and he was a Hasidic Rebbe in the same town that the Baal Shem Tov occupied in the Ukraine, called Mezhibish. He's called Rav Boruch of Mezhibish. He was a very serious person. And this Rav Herschel Ostropolier, who was a comedian, always used to cheer him up. So the story goes that he was really somewhat of a character, at least as the stories go of this Herschel Ostropolier. And we spoke about, beggars, I guess, evidently come up in these stories, because it's representative life that was. We live it, thank God. There's still beggars in the world, but life is a little different today. As we said before, the beggars, there's a whole class of beggars, itinerant beggars, and they would come from town to town, and people would take them in. One particular person, a man of wealth, really disliked the whole idea of being forced to take in beggars. You know, there's peer pressure. The shamish, the sexton of the shul, would impose, take this person in. He really did not like this. And in a way of showing his displeasure with the whole process, he would make sure that the guests would have a terrible experience in his house. So what did he do? First they would come in Friday night, he would make kiddush, they would wash, they would have challah, and he would engage the guests in conversation. Fish would be served, be the next course. The guest, out of politeness, was so involved in the conversation, answering the questions, that he wouldn't touch his food. Of course, the host and all those there were busy eating. And on cue, when the host was finished with his fish, the servant would come and clear off the table. And of course, this man, the poor guest, hadn't eaten his fish. And then the soup was served. And again, the soup was served. And again, he engaged him in conversation. The guest, out of politeness, didn't touch the soup. Everyone else ate the soup. The table was cleared. He had no soup. The same was with the chicken, and the same was with the kompot, with the dessert. The poor man had no meal except for the challah, in other words, for the bread that he ate in the beginning of the meal. The word got out, and very few people made their way to this man's house. Rav Herschel Ostropolier wanted to teach this fellow a lesson. He posed as a beggar, got himself invited to this man's house. And the man tried the same, after they had made kiddush and after they washed, and started the same routine and started asking, you come from Australia. And he started naming the people that he knew. And as soon as the first name, you know, Beryl the Schneider, you know, says, you know Beryl, who's the tailor. And Herschel looked down, and he says, gestorben, he died. The host was taken aback. His friend had died. And now Herschel was busy eating his fish. Finished the fish. The guy was in such a state of shock. The servants didn't know what to do, and they just cleared the table, and the host hadn't eaten his fish. And it came down to the chicken soup, and again he asked them about this fellow in Australia and the other fellow. Gestorben. He died. The man was beside himself, and Herschel was busy eating, and the poor man didn't touch his food. The whole meal went, and the man did not touch his food, and Herschel had a wonderful meal. After they had finished, and they said grace after meals, they benched. The man asked, and Herschel was leaving the house. The man asked him, what happened to Australia? The whole place died? He said, no, everyone's alive. It's a great life. What do you mean you told them they all died? So he said, I'll say it in Yiddish and I'll translate it. Wenn ich es, when I eat, bei mir die ganze Welt ist abgestorben, the whole world is dead. You know, there's a thing. There are people on this earth that, when they're involved, the whole world is dead. I do not. When I say death, I do not mean that. In other words, it's the idea that the other person comes first. You're humble and you respect the other person. And the final section is S is secrets. It's an important thing that, you know, we have as friends. We confide. I would just like to quickly just go down this last, because they're each one of them, these are quotes from Talmudic literature. Each one is very important. The first one is an Avos Rabbi Nosson, and he says, acquire a friend for yourself, the importance of having a friend. This teaches that one should acquire for himself a friend to be able to reveal unto him all his secrets. You need someone to confide in. However, there's a responsibility for that friend to keep a secret a secret. Now we quote here from Proverbs, a talebearer reveals secrets, but that is a faithful spirit conceals the matter. And we quote here from a Gemara in Yoman 4b, that when you're told something, unless you're told specifically that you're allowed to tell it over, everything that is told to you has to be held as a secret. Don't tell anybody else. And in terms of who you find to reveal secrets, he says, we quote here from this is from the Talmud Yevamos in 63b. Actually, it's taken from the book of Ben Sira, Ecclesiasticus. He says, many says, be they that seek thy welfare. You should have friends, but reveal thy secret only to one of a thousand. You have to be careful to whom you trust your secrets. It's important to have friends, as we said before, to give, but you have to be very discerning to whom you share those secrets. Again, let me just summarize this whole lecture, okay? Let me just go again through all of the letters and the acronym of friends, okay? The F of friends, remember, we said about the importance of having friends. Remember, they lift you up, they inspire you, they guide you, they help you, and as they prevent ill to fall upon you, and they teach you. And of course, but there's because it's important to have a friend, it's important to realize that there's an investment of having a friend. You have to be a friend, and acquiring a friend is all, perhaps could be a material investment as well, and it takes a lot of tolerance to keep that friend. But so R is respect. I is interest. You have to respect the friend. You have to have genuine interest of their feelings. Says E is empathy. They need a sounding board. Says N is non-threatening. Says even though your relationship to them, even when you give them, you try to influence them, should be something which is gentle and non-threatening. D is death. The one should be with humility. And S is secrets. Okay, you should have a wonderful night, and I hope in another month we'll be here together again.